Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century,
join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Welcome back to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. This counter-alto voice you're hearing right now is Matt Tebbe. I'm joined by Ben Sternke and Christy Penley. Good day to you.
Good day.
Hey, did you say counter-alto?
Yeah, you know, I used to get... Real talk here, Ben. I used to get mistaken. People have a hard time discerning... Christy knows this story.
Uh-huh. I do know this story.
People have a hard time discerning my gender if they can't see me.
Yeah.
So when I used to get like cold calls from, you know, the New York Fire Department asking for money, or let's say I'm in the drive-through line at an Arby's, you know, shame eating a roast beef sandwich. 50-50 chance I get called ma'am.
Interesting.
Usually.
I've been with you when this has happened.
So nobody believes me that it happens. Now, my voice has lowered over the years, you know. I've been taking supplements. And they're just multivitamins. They may have nothing to do with how my voice is lowered. Yeah. But I see. It doesn't happen as much as it used to. As a younger man, I really had a chipper, high-pitched, nasally... wine, kind of this, you know, whine. It's like a whining, nasally, grinding tone. You're really
talking it up.
I have a voice made for podcasting, is what I'm saying.
All right.
Yeah. So, anywho, I don't know how we got started on that, but
I just asked you.
Counter alto. That you know, my voice. So I used to sing professionally. People used to pay to listen to me sing. Mm-hmm. They all asked for refunds, but there was a no refund policy. And my voice is pitched really, really high, and it was almost I didn't know how to use my voice until I was almost done performing, and then I realized, oh man, I could have been singing like this the whole time, and then I was like, forget it, I'm going to be a pastor. So that's that story.
Yeah, using your voice in a different way now. So
now there's a different voice.
You podcast now as well. Mm-hmm. So that's,
I'm really coming along.
Your voice all over the place. Yeah, this is incredible. all those people who ask for refunds, man, they feel foolish now, don't they?
Suckers.
Yeah.
We're going to get into this podcast today. We talked to Willy Francois about his book, White Noise, which set off a tsunami of kairoses for Christy.
And for all of us.
Yeah, we talk about it after the podcast is over. So stay tuned for the after reflection.
Yeah, but we're approaching the end of 2022, beloved. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy. It seems, in my mind, like it's still 2020 or something. I don't know what's happening. But it's like the longest year that just never ends, and that, and it's going to be 2023 before we know it. But we're starting a campaign, an opportunity for you to partner with Gravity in a new way. Ben, would you tell us more about that? In particular, me, because I haven't, I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Just let you know what we're talking about here. yeah, so I mean, Gravity it has been going for. Not everybody knows this, but we started in 2015, kind of informally, and we really have been focused on trying to help Christians learn how to take love seriously as the center of our life and our mission as the people of God. And since then, we've been coaching. We've been we started a podcast. We've been training leaders in essentially a spiritual transformation framework that we've been trying to make both practical and reproducible. And we hear stories about, you know, emotional and spiritual health in lives of participants pretty much every week. And it's really encouraging, and it's been really fun to be part of this ministry that is Gravity over these years. But as you were pointing out, Matt, a lot has changed over the last few years. The global pandemic has kind of wreaked havoc on our ability to gather together, et cetera. There's communities and churches that are fracturing under the influence of Christian nationalism and kind of an unwillingness to face the legacy and the lingering effects of racism and colonialism and patriarchy and all of these kinds of things.
All the isms.
And just, what's that?
All the isms.
All the isms. They're coming online for us. And then, you know, we've talked on this podcast before about deconstruction, so to speak. And so there's a lot of people who, because of all these things and multiple other reasons, are feeling questioning their faith and needing to deconstruct the faith they inherited and need some care. And so anyway, all of this stuff has kind of added up to life as usual in the world of church and Christianity is, it's been extremely disruptive. And we've talked with other ministries and other pastors and other people who work in this space who say the same thing. It's just been extremely disruptive. It's been a crazy few years, and it's been hard to kind of know where it's all going. And because of this, we are feeling, I mean, just to be honest about this, we're feeling the need to shift a bit of the way that Gravity sustains itself. We hear from people every week who want the training that we have, but they can't afford it. We hear it from, you know, church planters, from pastors of small churches, and just from like Christians who are lonely and struggling to hold on to faith, and people who minister among marginalized communities. So we've realized, I think, that we need to shift how we sustain our ministry. I don't think we can expect anymore that everybody who needs what we do will be able to afford it in ways that allow us to keep functioning as a ministry. So we're seeking to raise up some ministry partners who can help to sustain the work of Gravity and to allow more people access to our training. So that's what we're seeking to do, and our explicit goal here is to raise actually $50,000 to invest in our work for 2023.
Which is totally doable. Mm-hmm. Totally doable.
Totally doable. I love your optimism, Christy.
Can I give a suggestion of what we do?
Yeah, that would be great. Go for it.
Okay, so Christmas is coming. And I'm sure everybody has these people that they don't know what to buy for. Like, I don't know what to buy for my neighbors or, like, people that you buy a gift for. Anyway, we started doing this a couple years ago for our children, but also for people that we give Christmas gifts to, is that we give a donation on their behalf to an NGO, a nonprofit, something like that. Yeah. And then we give them an ornament that kind of represents that thing. So one year we did a donation to Compassion International, and then all my kids and neighbors got like these little people ornaments, and it was like, you know, meant to kind of like remind them. And I made a little tag that told them like, hey, on your behalf, there was like a $10 gift or something that went to Compassion. But we, you know, to figure out an ornament that goes with Gravity Leadership, what would that be? I don't
know. Christy, you'd be the one to know.
Or headphones or something. I bet you can find it. Mm-hmm. Pink ones. I'm just kidding.
Pink headphones.
Or buy the book. Like buy your book, and then in the inside write like, hey, on your behalf, I gave a $10 donation to Gravity. Mm-hmm. And then they would, you know, figure out what is Gravity and learn about it, but also read your book, and it's a win-win for everybody. Plus it's like a meaningful gift. And so anyway, we do that, and we're doing that again this year. And I encourage our listeners to do that and use Gravity as their nonprofit.
That's a great idea, Christy. You are full of good ideas with the gift giving.
I love gift giving.
She is such a good gift giver.
Which, by the way, do you remember last year I sent you a box?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we opened it online, and we are doing it again this year, guys.
We're
doing it again.
Yep. We're going to open. We're going to open it live. We're going to have a special Christmas episode.
Yes.
So yeah, get ready for that. Well, anyway, listeners, I do hope that you'll partner with us if you've benefited from this podcast, if you benefit from maybe you've been in a coaching group and you're looking for a way to partner with us and help sustain this ministry, where this would allow us to offer scholarships for people who want to get into our coaching, making it accessible to more people. We do want to write another book next year focused on our Grace and Truth Matrix, and that would allow us some time to do that. It also would allow us to create a bit more stability at Gravity so we can kind of think creatively about the future and continue to do the work that we're doing. So every contribution helps. You can go to gravityleadership.com/partner to find out all the details. And I hope you'll partner with us.
Yeah.
And if you find a pink headphone ornament, somebody tell me. Somebody email me, because that I'm going to have to look now.
Yeah, because that would be the perfect sort of... symbolic Gravity Leadership gift, wouldn't it?
Yes.
It would. So good.
Indeed. So
good. All right.
All right. Well, let's get into Willie.
Yeah. Thanks for that great idea, Christy.
Yeah.
All right, listeners. Enjoy this interview. Matt, anything to say?
Yeah.
I noticed you take a breath there.
I do that. I don't know, 14 right before you're gonna to talk. 22 times a minute.
But that was like I'm about to say something breath.
I take breaths like a boss, you know? I do. So far. We'll see how the day goes. I just really appreciated Willie's candor and the way he challenged us. You know, we talk a lot about white supremacy and racism, and I think that is because we want to learn alongside our listeners, and we want to share. We want the learning to be generative. We want to invite people into our learning, and so Willie blesses us here. He's a great gift to the church and to us. So we get to share him with you now. Willie Duane Francois III joins us today on the Gravity Leadership Podcast. He's senior pastor of Mount Zion Baptist Church and president of the Black Church Center for Justice and Equality. He serves also as assistant professor of liberation theology at New York Theological Seminary and directs a master's degree program at Singh Correctional Facility. He created the Public Love Organizing and Training Project and has served in various organizations engaging in racial issues, including the Atlantic City Chapter of Black Lives Matter, the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Conference, and the New Jersey Department of State's Martin Luther King Jr. Commission. He's an active speaker and has written for HuffPost, Sojourners, The Hill, The Christian Century, and Religion Dispatches. Today, he joins us to discuss some of the themes in his new book, Silencing White Noise, 6 Practices to Overcome Our Inaction on Race. Willie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Matt, for having me.
As I read your bio, even as I wrote it down to read it and then read it again, I thought, how do you have time to do a podcast?
Or sleep.
It's a lot of stuff, Willie, that you're doing. What's a typical week look like for you?
Well, trying to navigate both church and the seminary is quite challenging. I don't think that I've found a rhythm just yet on how to make that as manageable as it could, on top of having a 2-year-old. That the toddler gets most of my time and demands most of my week.
Woo. Yeah, man, you're in the valley of the shadow of the diapers. You know, that's a real deal, man. A 2-year-old takes a lot of time. I told you off before we sort of hit record that this book's incredible. There are a lot of books about anti-racism, a lot of Christian books on racial justice. And Willie, your book is really profound, prophetic in so many ways. I want to start by just maybe asking you, who is this book written for, and why did you write it?
Sure. So one thing I say, I often say that this book is written for any Christian, any person of faith, really, but any Christian, more particularly, who is interested in leaning into anti-racism, racial justice, as a vocation, as an article of faith. So, you know, that's the wider audience. But, you know, I guess a more niche audience would be, you know, moderate to progressive white Christians who are looking for the language, looking for new language, who are looking for something practical and although grounded theoretically, that will allow them to lean into this work that I know is terribly hard for any of us to engage. But when you start thinking about what does it mean to divest from privilege and you have to stare in the spiritual and moral mirror and figure out how you are showing up in the public square in a nation that is founded on racism, I know that is incredibly hard for my white sisters and brothers. So yeah, that's the more niche audience that I think about. Those you know, who are center left, but really those in the center. I think the majority of us live in the center, who are looking for some inspiration, looking for some resources to accelerate the work that we do as disciples of Jesus, the work that we do to really make our nation be what it says it is on paper. That second question, I wrote this book as the country and maybe even the world was really set ablaze by the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. I was living in that moment with my own COVID fatigue, and I just really thought, you know, time is running out. I don't know how much time we really have to get this right. And then January 6th happened. And I understand January 6th to be related to both race and religion in a lot of ways. Race and religion live in the background of that mm-hmm. experience, and that just made it all the more critical for me to write this text. And then something more personal happened. I have a 2-year-old now. I became a parent in the middle of the pandemic, and literally in the hospital. I'm holding this black life and I'm staring at this black life, and I could not help but be overcome by the radical sense of vulnerability that this young life has, and that this life will always have as he carries black skin through a world that is organized against people who look like him in so many ways and for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, what a colorful and complex backdrop inside of which to write this book. I mean, I think most of us have never lived through a more liminal, loaded time than these, maybe since Black Lives Matter started in 2014. It's just been an incredible cultural earthquake. In your introduction, which, by the way, a lot of introductions are filler or fluff. It's like you have to have to write an introduction just to get people into the book. It's sort of a, you know, obligatory amuse-bouche, you know, before the main course. But this introduction, dude, is incredible. And I, it was like a buffet meal. And I tried to read it quickly because I wanted to get into the six practices. But it's a testimony to your skill and also what you share there that I couldn't read it fast. So we could do an entire podcast about it. But let's just give the listener a sampling. You contend that we need what you call reparative intercession to overcome racism. Would you introduce us to what you mean by reparative intercession? And then maybe as a subsection of that, why are most calls for, quote, racial reconciliation insufficient to accomplish that?
Yeah. So, I mean, thanks for such a glowing review of the introduction. but you know, I call us to reparative intercession because I'm thinking about the ways that we show up in this world as racialized beings is incredibly harmful. It's traumatic on both sides of whiteness, right? On both sides of white supremacy. There's a lot of pain, a lot of trauma that exists, and that needs to be repaired. And so I wanted to find language and develop a concept that honored the fact that we need to be in the practice, in the work of repairing the harms that have been done for more than four centuries in this country, that that the justice that we need is a justice that names just how vicious and just how vitriolic racism has been, to think about how it is baked into the very structures of our nation. It is not simply about what tiki torch carrying folk in Charlottesville, Virginia do. No, the reality is that we now live in a world that is so well organized and so well oiled that you actually don't need white people for white supremacy to be real. It lives in our healthcare system. It lives in our criminal justice system. It lives in our policing apparatuses, right? It is alive. And it is work that we have to, on a daily basis, commit ourselves to repairing, that both structurally and interpersonally. So I talk about reparative intercession as a way of interceding, as a way of standing in the tragic gap for those who are less protected, those who are most vulnerable among us, and you know, it comes from the idea of intercessory prayer, which is pretty popular in most Christian communities, where we pray on behalf of someone else. Well, our intercession needs to be more than prayer. It needs to be political. It needs to be economic. It needs to be social. How do we begin to show up and act up and speak up on behalf of people who are less privileged than we are and who are less powerful than we are? And to your second question, that is why I wanted to start with repair, because so many of the calls come from this, this well-intended place. You know, there are a lot of do-gooders who are white, who are committed to notions of reconciliation. But reconciliation cannot happen until justice happens first, right? Because the question that James Cone raises is, well, reconcile to what, right? Mm-hmm. How do we begin to repair relationships that have been harmed by centuries of violence, centuries of subjugation, centuries of domination, centuries of exclusion? That needs to be repaired. And we can't just jump into a kumbaya moment where we're allowed to feel good and we're allowed to pat ourselves on the back because we've achieved some level of cosmetic diversity. No, we actually have to slow this down and intentionally and painstakingly do the work of staring at our history, overcoming our naivete, our willful ignorance, and start to do the work of fixing what has happened. And reconciliation, unfortunately, the way we talk about it, does not require much of us. To do this work, we have to lose some things in the name of the whole. We have to sacrifice, particularly those who are most privileged, particularly those who are more powerful, that something needs to be sacrificed in order for humanity to live up to these ideals, for this country particularly, to live up to our print version of ourselves.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation. Yeah, I appreciate that way of talking about, you know, what sometimes is referred to as systemic racism, which sometimes feels like it's really hard for people to understand, at least white people to understand, you know, and I like how you said, like, this is so baked into our systems that we don't actually need white people for white supremacy to exist. Like that's a great way of talking about kind of where this stuff lives. And then I think the necessity of what you're talking about, like our intercessory prayer becoming embodied in our political and social practices. You name six rhythms in this book. Maybe this is a good segue into these practices, because, you know, this is how we do this, you know, reparative intercession, right? And so, real quick, I'll name these six practices. You talk about embracing difference as a gift. You talk about confronting the histories of whiteness. You talk about honoring our interdependence, exploring our fuller selves, sacrificing our power and privilege, and naming our complicity in racism. How did these six practices emerge and take form for you?
Yeah, great question, Ben. I've been doing anti-racist education for some time now. And as I was preparing to write this book, I was thinking about, well, what have I really distilled over the years of things that get in the way? What are some of the statements that really reflect a way of thinking and a way of being in the world that limit how we're able to show up on behalf of the other? And, you know, I started thinking about the ways that we tell ourselves, you know, as if it is some badge of honor. We say things like, oh, I don't see color, without honoring the fact that, you know, actually difference is good. And difference is really divine. In the book, I talk about embracing the divinity of difference, because each of us represent the diversities of the image of God. And so what are we saying about God when we do not allow ones to show up in their particularities, in their uniqueness? And also, what does that say about how we misunderstand other people's experiences? Because to not see my blackness is also an invitation to not own the ways that my social trajectory, my social life, in many ways is determined by this skin. So I started thinking through things like that, and I realized, no, that we have to embrace color. How do we help people embrace the power of color? How do we encourage people to be color conscious? I also, you know, encountered people who were not really interested in telling the truth about this country. That, you know, there's a kind of fiction that we lean into about America's greatness. And I'll be honest, yep, I don't know another country that I would want to live in. But we have to be honest that America's economic greatness, America's political greatness, is not a substitute, are not substitutes for where we're not morally good, right? I don't just want to live in a politically great nation. I also want to live in a morally good nation. And that requires us to confront our history. I started thinking about the ways that there are, you know, I grew up in a small town in Texas with poor white folk. And so I know that there are white people, a great majority of them, who don't feel privileged in any particular way. And although they don't feel privileged, it doesn't mean they aren't, right? They don't feel privileged in a particular way. And I remember how our lives were interconnected in that small town. You know, we were all dealing with poverty in some ways. We were all dealing with hopelessness in some ways. I think the opioid crisis that we lived through and are still living in right now is only a manifestation of the kind of economic hopelessness that is real. You know, the folk, many of the folk who stormed the Capitol on January 6th live with a very felt sense of disempowerment and disinheritance, because the promise of whiteness has not been shared by so many of them. Like, thinking through these things allowed me to start, well, how do I distill this in language and in images and imagery that I think would be compelling?
So helpful.
Mm-hmm. So good. Willie, in your book, you have at the top of each chapter, these white noise is what you call it. It was powerful to me. When I
Christy, you
I was actually with
book.
Matt. And I was like, oh my goodness, this book is for me. Because I'm trying to, like, learn and be educated. I need my friends of color to keep teaching me. And just reading those statements, I was like, I have a lot to learn. I have a lot of growing to do. But I'm curious if you can kind of help our listeners. How do those white noise statements correspond with these six practices and undermine our anti-racist efforts in these areas?
Yeah. I talk about white noise as the speech, the practices, the misrepresentations that allow white supremacy to continue. I think it's always important. I said a moment ago that white supremacy no longer needs white people. And I really mean that, because white supremacy is actually not about white people. It is about ideology. It is not about identity. It's not about ancestry. It's about a way of thinking and moving in the world. And Black people can also have anti-Black sentiment that perpetuates danger and harm for other Black people. So I want to be clear that these are statements that you find at these white noise, manifestations, examples of white noise can embody, can inhabit anybody. It can come out of any mouth, although we do know that it is more prone to come out of the mouths of white people. And these statements are really innocent, aren't they? Like these are things that you say that you know can be incredibly harmful to a non-white person. And they can be racist in a lot of ways, and you don't realize it. And part of what I was trying to do, Christy, was I was trying to show that that so much of the racism that we practice may, you know, Tommy Shelby talks about it this way, who's a great philosopher and thinker on race, is that, you know, a lot of the racism that we think about is, or that we practice, is kind of morally neutral. And I think it's important to say that, and I know that sounds weird to say, because when you say something is racist, somebody automatically hears that you are demeaning their character, that you're saying something about their identity, and that's not always the case. I talk about Judge Amy Coney Barrett in there, whose decisions and rulings have and opinions on the court prior to the Supreme Court have been racist. And you can name that some of the rulings that she's made have been racist, and she loves Black people. Particularly, she loves her Black children. Because when I'm talking about racism, I'm not talking about hate of Black people or disregard of Black people. I'm in many cases, I'm talking about the things that allow certain communities to voice and name levels of superiority or inaction that are not about hate, that are not about degradation, but it is a willful ignorance. It could be an averting of the eye. It could be, you know, an inability to engage in a more robust way. So what I try to unload racism of all of its morally negative connotations and dimensions, because we'll never. One of the practices that I talk about, one of the practices that I name is downbeat truth, right? It's the last one I name, downbeat truth. Harvesting the power of telling on yourself. How do you harvest the uncomfort, the discomfort of telling on yourself? Well, it's really hard to practice that if you're afraid to say to yourself, I've done some racist things, right? And so I wanted to create a space where people could say, you know what? That is racist. I don't want to be that. Being racist doesn't mean that I'm hateful of Black people. It just means I'm not as helpful. I'm not as constructive in the work. So those white noise statements that lead each chapter are opportunities for us to access our own bigotry, to access our own unawareness, to access our own racism in a lot of ways, and then to do the work of, well, how do I exercise these thoughts from my vocabulary, from my thinking, from my heart?
Yeah. Yes, it's powerful. It worked in me in the sense of it's in my bones, Willie. Mm. It's in my bones, yeah. And I don't want it there. Yeah. And it takes
effort and friends like you to continue to open up my eyes and to create an environment, even on this, on a screen. I know it sounds silly, but like for me to name that and to say, mm-hmm. I'm a racist. It's in there. And, yeah. and I want that weeded out.
Yeah.
So thank you.
You know, and thank you for that, Christy. And it's the same thing I have to do, as a man. One of the other practices, is this idea of the syncopated self, right? Syncopated identity. How do I, you know, I was trying to use as many rhythm metaphors as possible since these are rhythms of reparative intercession. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I do an intersectional look at myself and I see where I am oppressed, but I also see where I'm privileged. And oppression, mm-hmm. oppression and privilege live in the same body yes. all the time. And like you were able to say, Christy, how, you know, yes, you're racist. As great as I want to be in the world, I have to also name the ways that I am classist. I have to also name the ways that I am sexist. I have to also name the ways that I am heterosexist. And to name that, actually, it frees me to start to do that work. But I also yes. want to name as well. There are ways, and Matt, in that introduction that you spoke so glowingly about, I talk about my own anti-Black sentiment, like as a 17-year-old preacher talking about Black on Black crime, as if interracial violence is unique to Black people, right? Not realizing that when we talk about Black on Black crime, that's a way that we pathologize Black folk without naming the fact that, you know, the same percentage of white people who die are die at the hands of white people. The same percentage yep. of El Salvadorian people who die at the hands of other El Salvadorian Americans, right? But we use Black on Black crime as a moniker distinct for Black folk. And that was something I was spewing from the pulpit because of how I had been shaped, because of how I had been formed by white noise. When I talk about in chapter one, I talk about what does it mean to move from white guilt to white grief, and really I start to talk about this as racial grief, not just white grief, but racial grief, because if I'm honest, there have been times that I need to grieve the ways that anti-Black sentiment, anti-Brown sentiment, anti-immigrant sentiment has bubbled up in me. I tell the story as I'm talking about what does it mean to heal. You know, I use grief because whiteness is, and when I say whiteness, again, I'm talking about as an ideology, as a grammar, as a way of knowing in the world, not an ancestry, not a skin color. But when I think about what it means to allow whiteness to die to us so we don't die from it, I tell a story about one of my first racialized moments where I'm in middle school. And I'm in elementary school, and I call someone a Mexican who is not Mexican at all. And I say, oh, well, what's the difference, right? Although I was a child, that going unchecked only metastasizes. It only grows within us. So it's important for all of us to do that work of naming that we are races, that we have been shaped by whiteness, regardless of the color of our mm-hmm. skin, and that we have an obligation to exercise that from within.
We'll be right back. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Let's get back to the show. To review, because this has been a tsunami of conviction for me. Whiteness isn't about skin color. It's about a common sense, a logic, a way of being in the world that has done us all dirty, right? So all of us have internalized whiteness, and it doesn't do good work for any of us because it was invented to oppress people. It even oppresses the people who invented it, right? Number two, what I hear you saying, Willie, is that a lot of racism is perpetuated by things that seem innocuous or morally neutral. So most of the ways that whiteness is carried is by good ideas, right? I want to fix this racial problem. I know I'll be colorblind. Mm-hmm. Let's just, and that's the way that we overcome this thing, right? But it actually is a way to give it cover. I think this is really important because a lot of times when we talk about racism, we have this fixation on like personal, it has to be a personally volitionally chosen hatred or bias that I'm conscious of in order for me to be culpable of it, right? And so what your book does is it says, no, whiteness is way more elegant than that. It functions, because it would just offend us if it was only Nazi emblems and hoods. But if it can function at the level of propriety and social mores and common sense and normativity, then it can run, then the virus runs in the program unnoticed. Yeah.
That's exactly it. Whiteness or this white supremacy is so intelligent. It is so adaptable that it works beneath the consciousness. We don't know that it's working on us, right? And that is why we have to slow down enough and stare at ourselves in ways that allow us to undress all of the regalia that tells us what lives matter and what lives don't matter. To be honest about how racism intersects with all the other isms. None of these work in isolation of one another, and that's a point I attempt to make in the book as well. But yeah, it's we're swimming in it. We are as committed to whiteness naturally as fish are committed to water. You actually don't know. Fish don't know that they're in water until they're out of it. and we depend on this privilege. We depend on the power. We depend on the structures for things to make sense.
Yeah. In the conclusion, Willie, you mentioned three black men that have had a profound impact on me: Eddie Glaude Jr., James Baldwin, Cornel West. Can you talk a bit about their impact on you and their impact on this book?
Well, particularly James Baldwin. James Baldwin is who I say taught me how to write. I think he's the greatest American writer, not because he's an American who writes, but because of the way he writes about America. He is able to write about the fragility of our nation, the hypocrisy and the mythic innocence that we live with in ways that are just so compelling and so clear and so poetic. And I have attempted, and I hope to continue to attempt to write in that vein, to live and see and write and lead in such a way that is honest, and a way that is grounded in love. That's what Baldwin offers to me, a lens of love that disallows me to accept how things are, to continue to go along, just to get along, but to really figure out what does it mean to tap into the fullness of my humanity. And Baldwin introduced me to a Jesus that I didn't meet in church. You know, Baldwin himself is agnostic at best, but you know, I think Baldwin takes Jesus so seriously that he can't stay in the church, right?
Yes.
So Baldwin helps me to find a Jesus, right? That doesn't have to be divine only, right? To find a Jesus that doesn't take away all of our responsibility for preparing the world that we live in. And I owe that debt to James Baldwin through writing, a man that obviously I never met. You know, he was, you know, he died, you know, pretty early on in my life. But his life still lives because of the way that he opened my eyes to how Christianity could be better, and how America can be better.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe, one last question before we wrap up here. I think one of the things that I've noticed, you know, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and some of those events that you mentioned earlier also were sort of like, I don't know, they were flashpoints for me, I think for Matt as well, just to say like, wait, like we really have to reckon with this. And in the process of reckoning, trying to reckon with, you know, how racism lives in us, you know, in our communities, how it lives in our systems, all of that kind of thing. I got super tired, super quick. like just super kind of like tired of it all. And so I think that names one of the deficiencies of white Christianity is that we just have completely lacked, we're very fragile. We've lacked the formation to resiliently resist evil. And so we tried a couple times and then it just gets hard. And so, I think our, you know, the cultural supremacy makes us brittle, rigid, makes us peevish in our public witness. So maybe you can just speak to us about hope, and the need to cultivate, a more robust resilience as we endeavor to become Christian anti-racists.
Yeah. No, thanks for that, Ben. It's exhausting work, and mm-hmm. you can only imagine how exhausting it is to be a non-white person who yep. lives on the underside and sometimes mm-hmm. on the brutal side of the non-work that is happening in our worlds, in our jobs, in our courtrooms, in our hospital rooms. It is incredibly exhausting, and you know, I say in the conclusion, that's why we have to invent hope every day. You know, mm-hmm. every day has to be a new laboratory for invention, inventing hope. Every day we have to find new inspiration to continue to do this work. That's why I close that chapter with a prayer, because it really takes spiritual discipline to be committed to this work. And you never age out of it, but I like to believe that it becomes a part of our nature. It can become a part of our nature to be anti-racist the more we practice it. And so I think every day we have to find things that work for us that inspire us to continue to do this work. And sometimes that inspiration comes from confronting, as exhausting as it is too, confronting and familiarizing ourselves, this sense of cross-racial contact that I talk about in chapter one, is the mm-hmm. more contact we have with diverse communities, with diverse populations, the more we allow the doors of our hearts to swing open in the direction of other people. And we have to find those things that inspire us. There's no cookie cutter way to do it. There's no one size fits all that allows us to get there. But every day we have to tell ourselves, what will give me hope for this work and how can I lean into it? Is there something I need to read today? Is there something I need to watch today? Is there something I need to talk about in my contemplative time today? Is there someone I need to talk to today that can reignite that hope for me, that can become a part of that day's experimentation with hope and with these practices.
It's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I receive that. Hope is hard work.
Yeah.
But hope is hard, but it's worth it. Willie, just one final comment. This phrase white noise, what it makes me think of is the noisemakers we put on when our kids go to sleep. And it creates this white noise, right? This shh. And it's supposed to drown out other sounds that would wake our kids up during the night.
Sure.
Right? And I think that your book then is like identifying the things that keep us asleep.
Yeah.
And turning those things off so we can wake up and hear. And I just want to thank you again for this book, for your work. And much like James Baldwin could plumb the depths of the human condition personally, and also talk about it at 20,000 feet at the same time. So too, Willie, I think, and as I read this book, you were channeling the best of that Baldwin-esque voice of deep heart, like personal, intimate. I know who Willie is as I read, but then also talking about things from a macro level at the same time. And it's just a gift. And I appreciate so much the work you put into this.
Thank you so much, Matt, Ben, and Christy, for having me today, for supporting the book, reading the book, and I hope that your audience, your peoples, will be blessed by this talk, but also by the book.
Yeah, Willie, amen. If people wanted to read more of what you've written or connect with you, are you available anywhere online? Go ahead and plug your pluggables.
Yeah, so you can my socials are at WillieFrancois3 on Twitter and Instagram, Willie Dwayne Francois III on Facebook. Also, you know, our church's website is Mount Zion, spelled out Mount Zion, clc.org. And yep, those are places where you can find me. And if you're interested in doing some justice work, the work that we do at the Black Church Center, theblackchurch.net is another way to remain plugged in.
Awesome. The book again is Silencing White Noise, 6 Practices to Overcome Our Inaction on Race. Thanks again, Willie, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Y'all. I could talk to him for hours.
Yeah.
That interview or his book, his impact on me was a little different than other people that we've had on.
I noticed that, Christy.
It's powerful. And yeah. I guess maybe I'm even trying to reflect on what was it about that interview or that book that kind of hit me. And I honestly think that part of it is learning to have the freedom to name what is true about me and the truth and being having acceptance in that. So when he kind of said in that interview, you know, it's good to name that I'm a racist, that there are parts that I just need to name that and say that and kind of confess that. And then he did that back. There's something powerful to me in that because I think I live in a world where we pretend and we wear masks. And so anyway, I think I'm still chewing on that and it's still hitting me. What about you guys?
Yeah, I was struck by how it struck you, Christy, mostly. I was like, oh, this is really fascinating. But I just want to like, I think there's something really powerful about, you know, what you said there. And I think I think one of the things I noticed was the way that he very intentionally destigmatized like racism and made it not like this, like, oh my gosh, you are like personally a terrible, terrible human being.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because of that, like that sort of thing, he sort of destigmatizes it and allows us to not think that it's no big deal, but to realize how pervasive it is and how much it's not just located inside my own personal heart, yes. my own feelings about people of color or whatever, but we're all caught up in this system. And so we all have to learn how to tell the truth about it. And that's like, yes. that's just part of confessing. I see this in the, to put it in theological or scriptural terms, like this is confessing our sins. This is what it means to confess our sins to one another so that we might be healed, you know, as the book of James says. So I think that's a big part of it.
Well, thank you. You're naming something that I don't think I could articulate, but yes, that's exactly what it was. Mm. And the freedom to confess sin to each other and,
yeah.
and be loved in that.
Right.
Is transformational.
Yeah.
So
that's like basic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Confess yeah. your sins.
yeah.
yeah.
Oh, good stuff. Yeah. Matt, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell you're thinking. You're looking off to the left.
Listener, you can't see Matt, but he's looking straight up at the corner of his room.
Yeah.
We can tell he's thinking. Or yeah. there's a spider up there. There's a really big spider.
No, this is like moonshine EMDR I'm doing right now, you know, by making my own processing uh-huh. trauma just by right, moving my might... eyes up and down.
Yeah, yeah. I have two dots in each corner of the room.
Yeah, yeah. A couple things about Willie. One is I wasn't kidding. Like his book names what I've been trying to do and actually blesses what I've been trying to do and gives me permission to do what I've been doing and also helps me understand why nobody likes it or very few people like it. this is like really personal for me. Like, so that's one of the things I'm noticing in terms of, I don't know, probably around 2019, I just shifted my public voice on when it comes to racism and whiteness, going from sort of a circumspect, overly spiritualized, kind of, abstraction when talking about race to a very pointed, direct, concrete, confrontational way of talking about race. And when I did that, I realized I was transgressing something. I was breaking a rule. I could feel it inside of me and I could see it in other people's reactions. Mm. And Willie names that rule. And he names why doing what I've tried to do is important. Mm. Don't hear what I'm not saying. I still don't know what I'm doing. I mean, meaning I'm making mistakes when I do it, but it's the kind of mistake I want to make rather than the mistake of silence or complicity,
yeah.
or pretending, like dressing up problems as something they're not.
Mm.
And putting yeah. religious language on it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was thinking about that. And I was also thinking about one of the ways whiteness works is that it makes white supremacy so bad that you can never actually deal with it. For instance, the worst thing you can do to a white Christian is name that they're racist.
Right.
Just try to do that with a white person and see what happens.
Yeah.
It, all hell breaks loose, right?
Yeah.
So we like to keep our total depravity nice and abstract and general. Don't get specific on the way that sin touches my life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Willie actually, I think, helped me see a way of being in his book and in his person, being direct, being like not running away from conflict, but also doing it in a way that was winsome,
yeah,
and prophetic,
yes.
which is the really difficult task of
yes.
calibrating grace and truth when you're naming something that is a principality and power.
Yeah. 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 That's really true.
I experienced that actually.
Yeah.
For me to tell him the how I'm noticing racism and for him and for me to also feel like I want to be your friend. Like
yeah.
you are welcoming me in a way that I have not experienced before. And that's unique.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting to think about like painting white supremacy as
like the worst overt example, like white hoods, right? Mm-hmm. And swastikas. Mm-hmm. Like to paint white supremacy in that way actually is a tactic of whiteness. Yep. You know, to make it like, it's not normal. It's not just like the water we swim in. It's not just something that, oh yeah, we all got to repent of that. Mm-hmm. It's this awful thing, which because it's so stigmatized, like we can't talk about it because it's just, it is just so shameful. It's like calling someone the spawn of Satan. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just awful because of, yeah, the all the freight that we've loaded up with it. And so I really appreciated his work of both, like, as you said, Matt, like really directly naming things, but also like normalizing it and making it into something that's not to be like feared. Like we can talk about this. We're all affected by it, you know? Yeah. And so, and we have to talk about it and we have to destigmatize it in that way, not to make it normal or good, not normal in a good way, but like it's normal in a bad way to basically just say like, yeah. Like you said, like, what does total depravity look like? Well, it looks like living in a white supremacist society and we have to learn how to navigate that. So
let's have him back. That's what I'm saying.
Have him back.
Yeah.
Fourth co-host on the podcast every week.
Oh man, that'd be so good.
I want to like go write another book, man. Keep doing it.
If I didn't know that he was a pastor, I could tell that he was a preacher too, by the way.
Oh, right.
He goes into preacher cadence and yes. It's quite good. So
yeah, I'm a little jealous of it actually.
Hey, can I change the subject here real quick? I have a parenting question for you.
Oh, yeah.
What would you say to your kids if they asked you if trees poop or not?
Is this a joke?
This may or may not have happened to me over the weekend.
Yeah. What,
do trees poop, Dad?
What did you say?
Well, I said, where do you think number two pencils come from?
Matt, Debbie.
What?
Unbelievable.
And
number two.
And my child thanked me and wrote me a card. Yeah. And sat on my lap the entire afternoon.
With a pen. Because we're like, yes. I'm not touching one of those things again.
Oh, folks, there you have
number it. Number two.
Number two pencils. Enjoy that on your day.
Yep. All the 13-year-olds who listen mm-hmm. to this podcast, you know what's up.
They're into it.
They're into this. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, we'd love it if you tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
You can join our Gravity community for free. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles that we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our show is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tevi. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his work at aaronsturkey.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. Having fun in the sun or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.